coming up on Golf Today, how did Nelly Korda become the best player in the world? Well, Amy Rogers joins us with insights into Team Nelly, plus the world number one meets the media ahead of her title defense at the Chevron. And World Golf Hall of Fame member Ben Crenshaw has a new job, building Pinehurst number 11 with Bill Kaur. Gentle Ben stops by to share the details of the newest addition to the cradle of American golf. And the one-time super amateur, Neil Shipley, finding success as a pro. The Korn Ferry Tour winner hops on the show to talk big hair and birdies. Pull up a chair. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Today on a Tuesday, Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. We've got Ben Crenshaw, two-time master champ, World Golf Hall of Fame member, joining us with some news about the cradle of American golf.
Yeah, I mean, a man who's been responsible for so many of the best courses built in this country in the last 30 years, including Sandhills, Friar's Head, up in Canada with Cabot Cliffs, where he, of course, stole my course record from me on opening day.
What'd you shoot, 60-nothing? What'd you shoot out there?
I shot 76, and then Ben came along in the group behind me and shot 73, and I admit, I was in the first group out, and nobody else filed a score.
That's still very good golf. Looking forward that conversation. Also looking forward to the first major of the LPGA season begins this week with the Chevron Championship. This is the third year the major will be played at the club at Carlton Woods in Houston after having moved from California prior to the 2023 tournament. Now coverage begins on Thursday on Golf Channel. Remember what happened last year? World number one Nelly Korda beat Maya Stark by a couple of shots to win the Chevron for her second major. Lynn was part of an incredible year. She joined Nancy Lopez and Annika Sorenstam as the only players to win in five straight starts on the LPGA. Now, Amy Rogers on site all week and joins us now. Amy, you put together a great piece on golfchannel.com about Team Nelly, an inside look at the people who helped make Korda the best player in the world. She's very private, though, Amy. Why did she agree to do this?
Hey there, Damon. Well, how many times did we hear from Nelly Korda last year when she was successful, including here at the Chevron Championship, that she was giving a lot of the credit to her team? So I wanted to find out, who is this team that has contributed so much to her success? And as you just mentioned, she's very private and somewhat shy. So I wasn't sure that she would even agree to the story. So I ended up flying out to Las Vegas for the match play a few weeks ago to Shadow Creek and spent a little bit of time with Korda and her camp. I had a chance to sit down with her coach, her caddy, her trainer, and her agent, as well as Korda. And the first question I asked her, why did you agree to this story? And she said that she felt like it was a way that she could shine the spotlight on her team and the work that they put in with her week in and week out. And for her, it was just a way of showing her gratitude to them. Now, in getting to know them a little bit, she also told me that she is a very private person, as we've heard her talk about. She said it's just the way that she grew up. But what really surprised me is that she's also private with her inner circle, too. Part of the reason that she agreed to the story, she told me that she even has trouble a little bit expressing her own feelings to her team of showing them how much she does appreciate all the work that they put in. So she felt like the story was a chance for her to be able to say thank you.
Amy, what are the dynamics of that team like? Because there are some people out there who take this kind of team of rivals approach where they don't necessarily want a team that sort of merged together and that are happy working together. And there are other guys who kind of want a very kind of smooth team around a smooth dynamic. What is it like in the Nelly Korda team? Are they kind of seamlessly working together?
It's pretty interesting. They actually seem to be, there's a great camaraderie amongst the group, a lot of humor, a lot of sarcasm. They told me that all egos have been checked at the door. And this idea of having a larger team is kind of a foreign concept out here on the LPGA Tour. It's really only been in recent years that we've seen players have this larger sort of support circle around them. It can get quite costly, not only employing all of these people, but to also fly them out week to week to all these events. And Korda told me she actually got the idea from her parents who played tennis. She said growing up, watching her father, Peter, surrounded by a close-knit circle of supporters that he would go to dinner with and spend time with. And she told me even to this day that he will go and spend an entire team with his circle 25 years after they retired. That's really where she got this idea to build this sort of bubble around her, as she often refers to it. And when I had a chance to sit down with her team, I asked them, is this it? Is this the bubble that we've heard so much about? And they said yes.
Amy, I'm curious, what was the greatest revelation to you in reporting and writing this story, that maybe that aha moment that said, ah, this is why she is who she is. This is why she is so great. This is why this team works so well together.
They all share a common goal, and they told me that that is to make Nelly Korda the best that they can. And I think having that shared purpose and shared goal is what helps them to be successful. My impression is that their biggest challenge is time management. They tell me that Korda is very regimented in her schedule. In fact, her caddy told me that they have not deviated from the schedule they established when they started working together in 2018. That means meeting at the same time every day, eating at the same time every day, practicing for the same amount of time. Her schedule also includes 3 to 4 hours every day, 6 days a week, with her trainer. And that's working on not just the physical aspects of the game, but the mental ones as well. And then somewhere in that schedule, she also fits in all of these growing media demands. Now, her agent tells me that in trying to work these into her schedule, they try to prioritize those where Korda really wants to spend her time. He tells me that there's a lot of initiatives that she goes about away from the golf course that people never hear about because, again, Korda's very private and she doesn't really want people to know what she's doing. Now, with so many things on her plate and on her schedule, that really doesn't allow much time for celebrating either. Korda told me that there's just one victory that she has celebrated in her 15 wins on the LPGA Tour, and it came right here last year at the Chevron Championship, where she allowed herself the time to dine with her team to enjoy a champion's dinner. And it was a moment that the entire team told me was quite special as they finally got to digest all the history that she made last season.
Wow, terrific insight, and the world number one meets the media in just a little bit. We'll have that later on in Golf Today. I suggest you at home to pick up Amy's article on golfchannel.com. Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, here's how you can watch coverage of the Chevron Championship beginning Thursday at 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then again, it's 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's on Golf Channel. Same again Friday. Saturday, it's 3 to 6 p.m. on NBC. And the same again for the final round on Sunday.
Well, Eamon, meanwhile, the PGA Tour heads to TPC Louisiana for the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. The only official team tournament of the PGA Tour's regular season commences with two-man tandems competing in foursomes and four-ball play. How about Rory McIlroy and good pal Shane Lowry returning to TPC Louisiana to defend their title? No team has successfully defended their title at the Zurich since the team format was introduced back in 2017. Almost as memorable as the win, the post-round celebration. The two buddies belting out Don't Stop Believing by Journey on stage. You got the beads, you got the beer, and a lot of good times deep into that Sunday night. Well, Rory making his first start on tour since winning the Masters with more of the newest member of the Grand Slam Club. We welcome in Rex Hoggard. Rex, what should we know about Rory this week?
Well, I think the party's probably going to continue this week, Damon. As we all know, they love to party here in New Orleans. Now, officials expect Rory to arrive in New Orleans probably sometime this afternoon. As we all know, Rory flew home with his daughter to Northern Ireland last week to celebrate with his family and friends in the little town he grew up in, just outside of Belfast, as you pointed out, winning the Masters, completing the career Grand Slam. Now, he's scheduled to speak with the media about tomorrow, about noon our time, and that's before his Pro-Am tee time. As you pointed out, that'll be the first time he spoke with the media since completing that career Grand Slam. And according to one source, there had been some speculation that maybe with everything that Rory has going on in his life that he wouldn't come back and defend his title this week. But that source told me that was never an option. He always planned to come back and to celebrate last year's victory as well as the Masters victory alongside his best friend, Shane Lowry.
Well, Rex, there's also a chill vibe and a kind of a confusing vibe out there this week. I gather that Rex Højgaard caught up with Nikolai and Rasmus Hoggard out there.
I actually just asked them to pronounce my name because I struggle with their name so much, and they didn't want anything to do with that either, Eamon. That's very well done. You're right. This is such a different feeling this week than anything else we get on the PGA Tour, and it's because of the format. Teams have to spend the first couple days here getting used to playing with a partner. We don't have that anywhere else on the PGA Tour, but if there are two players in this field who are uniquely suited to this format, it's going to be the Højgaard twins, who played in this event last year and said their comfort level in this team format has never been higher.
Well, growing up, it was not only golf we competed in, it was everything. It was from who could run faster to the car and, you know, and all those kind of things. So, you know, it was very competitive growing up with him. And, you know, when we started playing team sports together, we could obviously ignite that fire a little bit together. So it's been cool.
Go back to last year when you guys were able to compete here. What did you learn about yourself that maybe you can apply this year?
I think that, you know, when we play this format, that we can play slightly more aggressive. Like, play your own game, not just trying to, you know, get the ball and play whatever it is, but play your own game and then help support each other. We've tried it from our younger years, and now we got slightly more experience. I think that will come in handy when we play the better ball. And the alternate shot is just about playing good golf. So, Russ, please play well. That would be nice.
How much of a conversation went into playing again this year, or was it just a matter of you were always going to do this?
I mean, it's a fairly easy decision. We both talked about what our schedule would look like, and then obviously this one looked nice on the schedule. So we were both, yeah, let's run it back.
How much is the comfort level between you two, having spent so much time on the golf course together?
We are very comfortable in each other's company and trust each other's advice. I think when we're out there sometimes, we know each other's game very well. And it's cool to have these weeks. You don't have them that often. And to really go out and have a week that feels slightly different, slightly more relaxed in a very competitive schedule is very cool. And I know it's going to be very competitive out there when we get on the first tee, but it's probably a week we can enjoy a little bit more and maybe trying to free up slightly more and just go out and trying to play good golf.
How much of it is advice when you're on the golf course together, and maybe encouragement? And is there any criticism whatsoever, maybe when you're on the golf course as a team?
Hopefully there won't be too much criticism, but no, I think when it comes down to choosing some shots, so if we're in a difficult situation, we know each other so well that if I tell him I think this is what you got to do, he will obviously listen to that. So, and that goes vice versa. So it's, I think in critical situations, we can rely on each other.
Now, on paper, you would say they are the perfect team, and it's because of what they were just talking about, sort of that boyhood rivalry that you have with your brother growing up. And you heard me asking them, talking about growing up, they competed at everything, including running. I had to follow up with the question, who's the fastest? And Nikolai said very quickly, I'm the fastest, but Rasmus has the most endurance. Both on and off the golf course, they make a good team.
Wow, Rex Højgaard on the Højgaard twins, one of the great tongue twisters in the game of golf. We appreciate Rex's time. And you want to watch some golf, some team golf, you can watch the Zurich Classic of New Orleans Thursday and Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. on Golf Channel. Into the weekend, 1 o'clock to 3 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel.
And the Højgaards are a partnership that Luke Donald might be keeping an eye on as he prepares for the Ryder Cup. And there's another one of those partnerships he's going to be paying attention to. Bob McIntyre, Thomas Dietrich, two recent winners.
And the teammates join us now from Zurich. Bob, I want to start with you. You both had previous partners before you got together and finished tied for eighth last year. What was the courtship like? Did you ask Thomas? Did Thomas ask you? How did it all work?
I don't think I had anyone left to ask. No, I was looking for a partner at this event, and my caddy at the time, Mike, he was said, "Oh, Thomas would be a good partner," and we asked Thomas and made it happen. And this year, well, when we walked off 18 last year on the Sunday, we just looked at each other and said, "We're doing it next year," and we both agreed to do it. And I had to ask Thomas again when he won in Phoenix. I was like, "You sure you want to play with me?" But yeah, here we are.
Thomas, there's a pretty relaxed, friendly vibe around most of the teams this week. Where do you draw the balance or find the balance between the fun part of it and the competitive part of it?
Well, that's the thing, you know. When you get here, you know, obviously people sort of approach the week thinking it's going to be a fun week, and I mean it is a fun week. But then we all competitors, I think, deep inside, and so the sort of competitive side always comes out. So we're going to have fun, but I think we're out here to compete. We're out here to do the best we can, and I think I'm definitely planning on improving that top eight from last year.
Well, you guys opened with 62 last year, Thomas. What's the process of choosing the ball, choosing what hole to tee off on? How easy or difficult is that process?
It is. I mean, luckily we are both guys who are pretty easygoing with equipment. You know, Bob played a little bit with his ball, then he took my ball. We sort of switched, and then same with the par threes. When we played alternate shot on Friday, he was playing the uneven holes, and then we played alternate shot on Sunday. I played the uneven holes. We sort of weren't really committed, but it worked. You know, he's obviously lefty, and the wind was strong off his right on 17 and 9, which obviously with water being on the left side is not really the easiest tee shot for him, so I sort of stepped up and took on those two difficult tee shots for him. But it was great. You know, we have a great chemistry on the golf course. Both being in European, we've spent a lot of time together playing golf in Europe the last couple of years as well. So I think it's going to be a good pairing again.
Bob, there didn't seem to be many people who enjoyed the last Ryder Cup more than you did, including the justified celebrations. Do you look at a partnership like this as a potential incubator for Bethpage later this year?
Yeah, 100%, especially the way Thomas has won. But again, we've both got to get there. We've both got to get in that team. And again, there's still a long way to go, but I mean, that's both our plans. It's mine anyway. I don't know Thomas's plans for that, but I know that that's one of my goals. And I enjoyed it an unbelievable amount, but again, I don't try and let that drive me. I let little things drive me. I think my game's been in great shape this year. Last 2 weeks haven't been as good, but you're allowed blips, and it's just about catching the blips at the right time. And I've got my coach out this week, and we're working on the right things. We try to catch. I think we've caught something early on, so we can hopefully have a nice stretch of whatever nine events coming up, and big nine events for the ranking points.
Bob, I caught up with Luke Donald, the European Ryder Cup captain, during the Masters. He said it was important for a European to win a major ahead of the Ryder Cup. I'm curious if you agree with his notion. Obviously, the Ryder Cup is important to you. Rory McIlroy wins the Masters. Why or why not important for Europeans to have success in the majors for the good of the team?
Yeah, I think it's good for everyone to have success at majors. I mean, that's what we're striving for now. I think it was incredible for Rory to win the Masters. It was the one that he hadn't got, and to be honest, he probably deserved it before now. And it was incredible to see it, to finish that Grand Slam off. And look, as much as he would be he's a playing partner on a Ryder Cup, I mean, I still look up to the guy. I'm 28 year old, a multiple winner, but he's the best for us to ever do it before Tiger, well, after Tiger. But in our generation, or the generation just before me, I think he's the best.
Thomas, you've built quite a career over here as well. Now, obviously, the victory at the WM Phoenix Open in pretty spectacular style on that back nine as well. I'm curious, why is your Wikipedia photograph still you as the 16-year-old that everyone talks about with the blonde flow from however many years ago? Is that ever going to change?
Now I've asked people online to never change it, actually. I think that one has to stay there forever. It's a good testament of how beautiful my hair looked when I was younger. it's a special one. You know, everybody talks to me about it, and it's a funny one. Actually, that picture was taken, funny story, it was taken at the KLM Open, the Dutch Open, in 2009, I think. And that was my first ever tournament as an amateur, but professional tournament on the DP World Tour. So that's what I looked like when I played my first professional event as an amateur.
Well, it's a good baseline for a reminder of how this game does actually age all of us. Bob, I want to finish with a question for you. You come from a culture where fast golf is the norm, and the PGA Tour has this experiment going now with rangefinders, and I'm curious if you think that's going to have any impact on the pace of play out there on tour, and is it easier or more difficult on a week like this where in some rounds you're only hitting half of the shots?
Well, I think it depends on the golf course and how people are using it. For me and my caddy, I found it a lot quicker, especially if you're out of position. If you're in the trees, it's a lot easier to just, if you're trying to pitch it back on the fairway, shoot a tree in the distance and know, right, that's how far we can, maximum we can hit it. Or if you're out of position and it's just an awkward angle covering a bunker, you can laser the pin and then the face of the bunker. So for me, I find it quick. But again, it can also be found slow. People can double use it. They can use that and then reaffirm it by pacing out. So it can also, it could slow it down as well. So it just depends how it's worked. But for me and my caddy, it's definitely been, it was quicker last week.
Well, I know you both would love to play with Rory and Shane in the fall at the Ryder Cup. This week, it's about beating Rory and Shane. Best of luck. Enjoy your week in New Orleans. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Back on Golf Today, an exciting conclusion to 2024 for Thailand's Gino Tittikum. Won the CME Group Tour Championship at Tiburon in November. Became the 2024 Race to CME Globe champ. Earned $4 million, the largest winner's prize in the history of women's golf. And she's building quite the resume. Turned pro in 2020, been LET Player of the Year as a rookie, LPGA Rookie of the Year, LPGA Vera Trophy winner for scoring, Race to CME Globe champ, 4 wins on the LPGA, including the 2024 CME Group Tour Championship. Her best Chevron finish, T4, a couple of years ago, and she recently sat down with our Amy Rogers.
Gino, you have enjoyed one of the hottest starts to the season. What is behind your consistency week in and week out?
I don't know. I mean, like, I'm trying to do my best every week. But, like, what's kept me different compared to my rookie year or, like, my second year, I think it's my putter. It was working really well better than, like, compared to the first 2 years. Maybe it's the secret, keep me, like, more consistently wise than, like, last year, too.
What does that visualization and process look like for you to be able to be so relaxed on the golf course?
Yeah, I think last year changed it a lot. After having been injured for the early of the year, starting my first week in Chevron last year and tied the lead on like second round or third round, I'm not too sure about that, but like it just more relaxing because I knew that after I got injured, I was just like, I really want to go pick off. No matter I just want to go pick off. No matter how I'm going to be shoot like 80 plus or 60 plus, but I just want to go doing my things. Just after that, I just be more comfortable, more relaxed, and just enjoy it. Did what I have been doing, you know.
How do you approach the week of a major championship like the Chevron Championship, which can be so demanding on you physically and emotionally?
Yeah, definitely major week going to be a hard week for us, all the players, because condition-wise would be tougher. Hopefully the weather wasn't going to be tougher than usual, but like I think, to my opinion, major just another week that I just doing my own thing. We just did our job as the same. It's 18 holes, that's the same every day. But it's just like, you know, changing the course, changing your emotional-wise avenues. But just, I just trying to keep it really simple.
With all you've achieved in recent weeks and months on the LPGA Tour, you're the highest-ranked player in the Rolex rankings that hasn't yet won a major championship. Do you feel a pressure to try and get to that next step and to win a major championship?
I don't think I feel pressure, but I feel more excited what the future hold on for me because I knew that I'm still caught as a young still. So I think it's just really much more for me that future holds on. I'm not gonna, like, I still think if I'm not gonna win a major, I'll really proud of what I did in my career. it would be really great if I can get one. And I definitely want to get one too. But like I said, I'm not gonna put pressure on myself. I don't really think it's too serious, and I demand it that much because I knew that everything, it just came from nature.
How did you get such a great perspective at such a young age?
Life threw me, I know I'm just 22, but like life and then golf taught me a lot. I think golf taught me to be like more mature, that more than my age. So that's why, you know, on this tour have taught me all my life, all what journey that I have been through.
Well, you already have 7 top 10s in major championships. What have you learned from those experiences that can help you at this first major championship of the season?
I knew that I love a tough condition. I knew that I love, like, because it tests your skills. It tests every part of your game. And I think, like, one that I haven't been learned from all the major is be patient. Especially at US Open week, I was like, you have to be patient. And then that's pretty much how I learned. And then I knew that your games, it's going to be more like, you can't just play only one shot, or you can't just play only like one type of the shape shot, but you have to, like, you know, got a lot of more skills than just one. So it's just really what I have been learned through all the majors.
Well, you certainly have more than one skill. We have seen that with your recent success on the LPGA Tour. We appreciate you spending some time with us and wish you all the best at the first major of the season.
Thank you. I wish you my best too.
Such an engaging player. And let's take a look at who's who in the race to the CME Globe. And Gino Tittical is right there at the number one spot, just ahead of Angel Yin. Some big names on that list, though. You see Lydia Ko on there, Minji Lee as well, rounding out the top 10.
Well, moving up the charts, the latest winner on the LPGA Tour, Sweden's Ingrid Lindblad, as she gets set to make her Chevron debut this week in Texas.
Ingrid joins us now as she's preparing for the Chevron. Ingrid, congratulations on the victory. Were you surprised that it came so quickly, or is this kind of what you expect of yourself?
I mean, I had set up a goal to win this year, but I don't think I'd expected to win this early in the season.
What was the wait like for you? EY had to finish. You're up there behind the green. What was the self-talk like during that interminable wait?
I came into the scoring area whenever I finished, and I was kind of like, I just need to sit down for like 2 minutes because it's been a lot going on the back nine, like a lot of thoughts, and I feel like my pulse was pretty high on the back nine too. And then kind of just talked to a world's official, and I was asking what was going on, and they said she had about a 10-footer to stay at 21 under, and by this time we're kind of behind the stands on the 18th green, and you hear the, you know, not the cheering, it was more like an oh, she missed a putt, kind of roar. So that's when I found out I won.
You say you set the goal to win this year, Ingrid. Now that you've done that, and we're not even in May yet, how does that actually change your goals for the rest of the year?
Oh, well, I've already gotten this question a couple of times today, but I think I have to put up another goal. I don't know if we're talking more wins or major championships, but I need to put up more goals, but I don't really know what it is yet.
Here at LSU, you won 15 times. If at any time you had decided to turn pro early, the pundits would have said, that's fine, she's a great player, but you stayed 5 years. Why?
I really liked the atmosphere at LSU. We had some great coaches, great practice facilities and everything, so I was just trying to be as good as I could when I left LSU, and just, you know, try to get as good as I could before going out on tour.
We had the Hall of Famer Amy Alcott on the show yesterday, Ingrid, and she talked about how she learned from veterans when she first went out on tour 50 years ago, She wishes that younger players now spent more time around older veterans, kind of picking their brains. Is there anyone out there on tour right now that you do kind of use as a mentor to try, as you find your feeting?
I've talked a little bit to Anna Nordqvist, mainly. This was like a while ago when I decided to play LPGA qualifying in the fall of my final year at LSU, and we were kind of talking about, she's like, you don't have to stress out here. Kind of take your year on absent and then see where you're at. And then, well, now I'm out here and I'm a first-time winner, so I feel like that was pretty good advice.
Well, you're making your tournament debut this week at the Chevron. What is that process like of learning a golf course, seeing it for the first time, picking out sight lines? How do you go about your business?
I think I just want to play nine holes today, play nine holes tomorrow, and it's like Madeline said on Sunday, like you've played golf before. It's nothing crazy. So just trying to get some lines off the tee and see where it's good to hit it into the greens and everything.
Do you feel more pressure this week, Ingrid, because you're coming off of that victory and you're probably not going to be able to fly under the radar at the Chevron?
Oof, good question. Maybe a little, but I think you should just treat it as like any other week. It's another golf tournament. Yes, there's more money to play for, but it's still another golf tournament, another two rounds and a cut and then two more rounds. So just trying to take one day at a time.
You said nine holes today, nine holes tomorrow. Just from being out on the property, how do you sense that this golf course might set up for your game?
I heard the course was very firm last year, and this year it seems like it's very, they had a lot of rain, I heard Sunday, between Sunday and Monday, so I think it's going to play a lot different than last year, which I don't know if that's a good thing for me, because, you know, players who saw it last year, they'll probably think it plays a lot different, but I didn't see it last year, so I can't, you know, tell a difference from last year. But I'm excited. I'm to try to see the golf course and hit some golf shots on the course, so we'll see what happens.
You mentioned Anna Nordqvist earlier. Anna, of course, is the Solheim Cup captain next year. Do you allow yourself to think that far ahead of what it would be like to play for Anna in the Solheim Cup?
Yeah, I mean, I watched her first Solheim Cup in 2013, and, you know, I watched it, and I said, that's pretty cool. That'll be cool to do one day. So, yeah, it would for sure be really fun to play for Anna.
Well, you got the big hat, the proper sun coverage. You know, should you win, would you dive into the lake and do what Nelly Korda did 1 year ago?
I have no idea. I have not gotten that far into this week yet.
Well, there's still time for practice holes and thinking about Sunday, but a lot of time between now and then. Thanks for the time. Congratulations on your win in Los Angeles as well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, Amy, in case you didn't know, buddy, today, April 22nd, is Earth Day, a day to celebrate our planet and draw attention to environmental issues. This year marks the 55th annual celebration. And right now, we're joined by Rhett Evans, CEO of the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. Rhett, great to spend some time with you. How about for our viewers who might not know, can you explain the environmental impacts golf courses have on communities and just how vital the golf course superintendent is to ensuring environmental sustainability of a golf course?
Well, first off, thanks for having me, gentlemen, and happy Earth Day. For our 21,000 GCSA members who wake up every day to head to the golf course, this is a great day for them. We get to see the fruits of their labor. They go to work to make golf more sustainable and more enjoyable for, you know, the 26 million golfers that enjoy this sport. And certainly, first and foremost, it's that we all get to enjoy a beautiful round of golf. Over 545 million rounds played last year. So we're all consuming it at a record level. But the other thing that we want to talk about today, as it is Earth Day, is really what's happening from an environmental standpoint. our members are just doing some terrific work. They're able to take a lot of the new technology and put it in at the golf course, whether it's dealing with drones and satellites and moisture sensors, et cetera, and creating some great opportunities to make some movement as it relates to sustaining the game and using less water and inputs and really, I think, making golf better in terms of its playing surfaces and so forth. So it's a great day today to recognize those 21,000 GCSA members who are sustaining our sport and making it enjoyable.
Brett, do you still fight a perception that golf courses are not good for the environment, or has that notion kind of lost credibility at this stage?
I think it's definitely getting better in terms of the awareness that golf courses, you know, when we look at the 2 million acres of green space in the United States that make up those golf courses, I think non-golfers and those that are living in a community that have a golf course are recognizing the value that that property brings to their home value, that brings to really their community as an asset. You look at what it does in terms of, you know, a stormwater runoff from the neighboring parking lots or the neighboring strip malls and neighborhoods. That golf course is the retention area. It's able to, with that turf grass, filter the pollutants, and the water leaves that golf course cleaner than when it entered. I think people are starting to recognize that. They're seeing that these are wildlife corridors to be able to protect wildlife. All of the programs that we're doing with pollinator protection and habitats, they're seeing what's happening with that. So I think we're changing the story there, and people are really understanding the environmental benefits of a golf course. And so it's pretty fun to watch.
Well, several years ago, the GCSAA launched that First Green program, which brings young people out to the golf course for hands-on learning experiences. How is that program progressing?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because that thing has just taken off like wildfire, no pun intended. But what a great opportunity for young people. We're taking them from all ages, whether they're in elementary school, junior high, and we're putting an emphasis on high school now. But it's all part of STEM learning and STEAM learning, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And there's really no better learning laboratory than the golf course. When you think about the science, you know, what's going on there at a golf course, looking, as I mentioned, whether it's the drone technology, it's looking at the pollinators and what's going on with that habitat and how the science all works together in this ecosystem. When we think about engineering, the equipment that's used to maintain a golf course, and of course, jumping down to one of our new curriculums around the A or the arts, you look at the design, you look at photography, all that goes into, you know, the beautification of a golf course, that art is vitally important as much as the science. So it's going great. Over 18,000 young people have been out to a golf course, many of whom had never stepped foot on a golf course, and it's pretty neat to watch those students as they walk onto a green, and the first question they ask, is this real? And it is, and they get a touch and feel the green and get to see the work of our members and all they're doing to make that track beautiful. So it's going extremely well.
National Golf Day is in Washington, D.C. next week. What message do you want to send to the policymakers in Washington?
You know, I think if we just had them watch this segment, right, about Earth Day and what golf does for the environment, I think that's the message that we want to send to those that may be new in Congress or be unfamiliar with our sport and our game. I think there is, again, as we talked about earlier, some misconceptions about the sport. I think they look at, obviously, and the players and, you know, that are shown on your segment, you know, during major tournaments. But that's only a portion of what golf is. You know, with over 2 million people working in the game, the fact that it generates $226 billion in economic benefits to communities around this country, the fact that it generates $4.5 billion that goes to charities around this country. Those are things that people need to be aware of. And then certainly the environmental benefits, that it's an asset to a community, not a liability. all that goes on at that golf course with the turf grass. So that message needs to resonate, and we're going to have over 300 folks going to Capitol Hill here in a couple, well, just in a week, and sharing that message with the members of Congress. It's great to see the industry with the American Golf Industry Coalition coming together, whether it's with the PGA of America, the USGA, the PGA Tour, LPGA, the owners, architects, builders. They're all going to be there, and we're all going to share this message in a unified voice and really, I think, make a difference for the game. We've got a lot of issues facing our sport.
Well, I know it's a busy time for you, Rhett, and also the superintendents who wake up at dawn and before every single day. Happy Earth Day, and thanks for the time.
Hey, thank you, guys. Have a great day.
Making the turn here on Golf Today. When we return, we're catching up with two-time Masters champ Ben Crenshaw with some exciting news surrounding a new course at Pinehurst. Stay with us. And the World Golf Hall of Fame member joins us now. Ben, I'm curious about the conversation you had with Bill and Tom Pashley, and what were the conversation points like, and how quickly was the answer yes, that this was something you and Bill wanted to take on?
Well, I'll tell you, this has been a long time coming, Damon. I've been on the site one time, and it was before the 2014 Open at Pinehurst. This is a golf course that we've entertained on the piece of property that was built a long time ago called The Pit. Dan Maples of the Maples family from Pinehurst did that golf course, and we went out and scouted it out. We have a different routing that we proposed. The sand is there. Some very, very nice trees are there. It's interesting that it's right next to Tom Doak's new number 10 golf course, which is right near it, but Tom's course is very open, a much bigger piece of property, but we're very excited about what we've seen. So we're anxious to start clearing later this fall, and it's an honor to do anything at Pinehurst. I think y'all know that.
Yeah, Ben, you and Bill obviously restored the number two course prior to that 2014 Open. You're a historian of golf as well. What does it mean to you to actually work in a town like Pinehurst, given what it means to the history of American golf?
Big pressure, because I've seen Pinehurst a long time ago, and there has been volumes of things written about how Donald Ross loved the number two course, as well as all the work that he did around Pinehurst. He was fascinated with sand, of course, being from Scotland. He found it was ideal for drainage. Sand, as you know, Eamon, it's a blessing anywhere you can find it. It's such a medium that it makes drainage so much easier. You can move it. Golf and sand seems to have gone together from the very beginning. So we look for green sites first, and link holes together. And I swear to goodness, Bill Coor, my partner, is and the very, very best at routing. It's one thing to find individual characteristics of individual holes, but to link them up together, I think there must be a theme and something you work very, very hard on and try never to repeat yourself. So it's all fun and fascinating, but to find your way around is the trick of it.
Well, on that note, Ben, I was fortunate to play golf with you and Bill at the opening of Stream Song Red, also on a property that had a former life in mining with all those deep reservoirs of sand that you're talking about. Are there any echoes from Stream Song that we might see at Pinehurst number 11, at least in the versatility and the options that you will have?
Well, I think the similarities of Sandy features will always be there. That's what is possessed on this piece of property. You want to give people options. You sure do. You have diversity of holes. You vary your par threes in length. You vary your par fours in length. Occasional par five, but they have to fit on the ground. I just remember a distinct line that Donald Ross wrote a long time ago. And he said, make your holes fit the ground. He said, there's no other way. That was pretty stark, but he very, very much believed in natural features and capitalizing on them. It's a goal that we work wherever we work. It has to fit. We try not to fight the land. It's always been one of the things that we come to mind. We would rather pass on a piece of property that we know that we'd have to tremendously disfigure it. So that's how we work.
You and Bill have built some of the most acclaimed courses in the last 30 years, Ben, on spectacularly different pieces of land, whether it's, you know, Cabot Cliffs up in Nova Scotia or Friar's Head, Kapalua, Sand Hills. How would you distill your design philosophy that you guys have? How, in what simple terms could you explain how you guys go about it?
We first of all, you obviously obtain a map, but maps are not entirely accurate, Eamon. We very much find that the best way to do it is to go out and walk, and just walk and walk and walk and try to try to take everything in so far as soil types, undulations, prevailing winds. You ask questions of let's say people who work on golf courses in a certain area, and you try to absorb any information that you can that makes things comfortable. As I say, we don't try to fight the land. There's places where a natural course might evolve, and there have been wonderful golf courses that have taken a lot of work to hammer them into submission, but we're just not comfortable with that. We know that there's so many talented people in the business that have taken inferior ground and made beautiful golf courses with them, but we just prefer to make a light imprint, as it were. So we there's a certain look about courses that, you know, proportion, balance, bunkers, and very much proportions are what we're after.
Ben, so much in life is about inspiration. You told me years ago you would take annual trips to Shinnecock and National just to walk the land and to play and to kind of let those beautiful designs wash over you for inspiration. How important are those original designs and those old school Long Island golf courses still important and inspirational to you?
Vitally important. Damon, I was really lucky in that I came out of Texas when I was like 15 years old, and I made my first trips up east to start playing golf, and I just fell in love with the eastern golf courses around Boston and New York, and I got to visit. Even when I was playing on the tour, I would make side trips to go see a golf course that I'd read about, and there's no substitute for being on those sites, and you get in your mind, you know, you say, what makes this special? It always looked to me like golf holes always fit the land. Bunker sizes, bunker looks, sizes of greens, diversity, you know, short par fours always sort of abound. I love short par fours. I think they add a great element. And then you have some tough holes as well, but I just became enamored of a traditional look. And I've read, my head's been in a book a lot, And it's been a joy in my life.
Ben, you've always had a great affinity for Augusta National, not just from having won there twice, but also from its architectural standpoint as an Alistair McKenzie golf course. Is there one hole out there, since the audience is intimately familiar with that golf course, what would you say is the most underrated hole out there that doesn't actually get the appreciation it deserves?
I'll say this, Eamon. I think the hole in the green that doesn't get a lot of attention is number 17. 17 was a green that was built by Perry Maxwell, who was in business with Dr. McKenzie a long time ago, and he had finished the course. But that green is a wonder. It has a raised plateau in the middle, very subtle, but it divides the play between the left side of the green and the right side of the green. The right side of the green is very slippery. And if you putt from the left side of the green to the right side of the green, it's extremely fast, and the speed gets away from you, but very exacting. You come over that front bunker, but you know, if you'll find a lot of, and back through Masters history, that 17 has held itself very well. There have been some late mistakes there, been some birdies there. It's a green that doesn't get much scrutiny, but it's a marvel. If you've seen a lot of Perry Maxwell greens over the years, that's a beauty. That's a beauty there.
Ben, you talked about how mindful you are of this opportunity to build number 11 with Bill. I'm curious, when you guys have boots on the ground and you start building this golf course, how much will you look around and peek at the other courses in the area for a reminder, maybe pop over to number 10, or will you have the blinders on and not be too influenced by what's been built or going on around your golf course?
Oh, no, I tell you what, when we were there, we went to number 10. I've seen number 10, you know, built by our friend Tom Doak and a wonderful girl named Angela Moser, who's a great, great shaper in her own right. She's on the dozer. She does a lot of work for Tom. It's a completely different piece of property. It's very open. It's vast. Ours is a little more intimate. But that's just the way the ground lies. We have more vegetation. We've got sand. They've got sand too, but I think it will be a nice complement. But they're very different. So I think it's, and in the Sand Hills region of Pinehurst, you know, it's, thank goodness it is possessed of sand, but the ground features, the ground undulations are different.
Ben, it's always great to spend some time with you. We always learn something from talking to you. And when you're building this golf course, please keep in mind, for guys like us, the fairways need to be really, really wide. So don't disappoint us on that one.
I appreciate it, fellas. We try to make courses playable.
Your definition of playable and ours, two very different things, Ben. Enjoyed the time.
Pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Well, this guy coming up showed a flair for the dramatic of the weekend. Neil Shipley earned the maiden victory of his professional career on the Corn Ferry Tour in a lengthy playoff. He's going to join us right after this short break.
Great to have Neil Shipley with us from Texas, the Veritex. Great to see you. You made 30 birdies, 5 in a row on Saturday, 7 out of 8. At one point, you strike me as a guy who wants the ball at the end of the game. How much did you just love how your first win on the Korn Ferry Tour came together?
No, it was great. I felt like, you know, it was a little bit of a come behind victory, you know, coming from four shots back, which I love. And I felt like I was applying a pressure to the guys ahead of me on the leaderboard all day. And I like that. I really didn't feel pressure. I was trying to apply the pressure, which is kind of our mindset for the day.
You're still pretty early in your professional career, obviously, Neil. Did you feel as though you were still on a learning curve, or did you actually expect to win when you got out there?
I felt like I had the game to win, but I'm coming to the golf courses where some of the guys have been here 4 or 5 times, and I'm learning the golf courses and you know, still adjusting to traveling and doing all those things, all the little things that comes with professional golf. And so I definitely feel like I'm on a learning curve. I'm learning, but I think my game's good enough to compete out here. And when I play well, I've been able to contend.
How about the adjustment to fame? I mean, Netflix, commercials, meme, the hair. I mean, you got it all going on. How do you balance letting your clubs do the talking, but also kind of embracing what seems to be budding stardom?
Yeah, it's been awesome to have a lot of attention, you know, this early in my career. I've really enjoyed it. It's great to have a lot of people come up to me and love seeing my fans and meeting my fans. But at the end of the day, the golf clubs is what's going to take care of that in the long run. And so I'm just trying to focus on that. But no, it's been really cool to have that attention and have a lot of my family and friends text me like, oh, I just saw your commercial again. It seems like it happens every Sunday during the broadcast. So it's been a lot of fun.
Have you gotten used to seeing your own face as a meme yet, Neil?
You know, I see myself on social media all too often nowadays. So I'm just kind of getting used to it. I'm enjoying reading through some of the comments, some of the funny comments. It's a good way to pass some time.
Neil, I've got three teenagers at home. They don't like going to the barbershop. They want the long hair. At some point, you made a decision to have the long hair and to let it go. When did you make that decision to kind of have the long locks?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of started to grow it out maybe my third year of college at James Madison. And, you know, I'll be honest with you guys, you know, after the U.S. Open or U.S. Amateur, I was kind of planning on cutting my hair, but I finished second and I became the guy with the long hair, and I just couldn't cut it. It just had to stick.
All you golfers are superstitious. You've played in a lot of different countries already this year, Neil, as you're kind of finding your pathway to the big show. How tough has that adjustment been just to being in different environments all the time?
Yeah, I mean, that's really tough early on, especially when it's your first eight events or six events are all down south in South America. We do a couple in the Bahamas. You know, Bahamas is pretty easy. It's like, you know, kind of like any Caribbean country if you've ever been to one. But when you start getting into, you know, Panama and Colombia, and especially Argentina, Chile, just the culture is so different. And obviously, I don't speak a lot of Spanish, so that can be tough when you're just going out to restaurants and hanging out. So I feel like that it's a tough way, but, you know, they kind of throw us in the fire early, and then you get back to the States and you feel really comfortable up here, and, you know, it feels great to be home.
Speaking of home, you're from Western PA, big golf championship coming up in June at Oakmont. You told my good buddy Jerry Dulac, longtime Pittsburgh golf writer, that Oakmont is central to your story as a person and a player. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I had my first job was at Oakmont as a caddy there in, you know, kind of beginning of college and for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, a lot of the people that I met in Pittsburgh that are influential and helped me out throughout my golf career are members at Oakmont. And, you know, it was my first USGA championship. You know, it's just, I think, you know, I went to the 07 and the 16 Open. I got to watch Tiger in 07 during a practice round and got to watch, you know, Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and all those guys in 16 compete at Oakmont. And I feel like that just really spurred me on to try and become the best golfer possible and compete at the highest level. And I don't think I'd be where I am right now if it wasn't for Oakmont and some of the people there and the membership.
Well, I assume winning this year was one of your goals for the season, Neil. Where is getting into the field at Oakmont and among your goals, and what are the other goals as you move through the rest of 2025?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the US Open would be a huge bonus, you know, being right in my backyard. I love the golf course. It's my favorite golf course in the world. And I'd love nothing more than to play in the US Open there. But at the end of the day, you know, the bigger picture, you know, I really want to be on the PGA Tour next year. So that's a huge focus of ours. You know, getting a win is awesome. You know, it's really hard to, you know, make it into the top 20 of the points list if you don't win. So we kind of took care of that early, and, you know, we're just trying to keep building off this and keep accumulating more points early in the season and hopefully knock that out pretty early.
Neil, we got people in common. One of my good buddies is Alan Citron, longtime member at Oakmont. Lance and Eddie, great caddies, brothers out there, have looped for me. Just for the folks at home, I think Oakmont is absolute American golf royalty. In your mind, what makes Oakmont special?
Well, I mean, you just go back and look at the list of people who've won there. I mean, it's an unbelievable list. I mean, it's a who's who of golf. You have, I mean, obviously you have Jack Nicklaus and Hogan, and just all the history there. It's so cool. And not only that, I think, you know, the people who are members there, there's very they've been very influential in the golf world and in the, you know, business world in general. And it's just a cool place where those two worlds have kind of collided.
Yep, and quite easy to four-putt, as I am well aware. Neil, congratulations on your win, buddy, and best of luck for the rest of the season this week and as you try to make your way to Oakmont. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
There he is, Neil Shipley, Western PA royalty. And the guests keep rolling on this Tuesday edition of Golf Today. Two-time Chevron champ Brittany Lincecum stops by next. Great to have Brittany Lincecum with us now from Houston. She is in the field of the Chevron. It's great to see you. You walked away from full-time golf, but now you are back. What compelled you to play this week?
Yeah, I think that's why I said semi-retirement, because I knew I was still going to play this event. It's just in my blood. I love the game of golf. So to be able to come back to this event where I've won twice, it just seemed like the right thing to do.
When you're not playing a full schedule, does that change your expectations for the week, Brittany? And is that a way where you have to kind of rewire yourself from what your expectations were when you were playing a full schedule?
For sure. You would think I would be a little bit calmer, just go with the flow, whatever happens, happens. Obviously, I'm not practicing as much as I used to. With a daughter in kindergarten, a two-year-old at home, it's very busy. Not a lot of time for practice, but I think once you're a golfer, you're always a golfer. So it's in my blood. The competitive edge is always there. If you have a bad day, you know, you're just like, gosh, you know, I know I can do better. I know it's in me. I know I can hit that shot. So it's still equally as frustrating. I think that's why we all love this game. It's always ever-changing, and it's never the same. So I think that's what brings us back.
Well, you got the hat on, you got the look, you got the game face going, and you have some good history on this golf course. You finished tied for 23rd. You finished tied for 30th as well. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on how this golf course kind of fits your comeback this week?
Yeah, it's a long hitter's golf course, which obviously getting closer to 40, I don't hit it quite as far as I used to, but still far enough. And a lot of the holes are right to left, and I love hitting the draw. So it sets up really good for my game. There's maybe two holes out there that are a little bit scary off the tee, but after that, it's kind of bombs away. And assuming I can get that flat stick working, which is pretty much everyone's issue, I think I could have a really good chance this week.
What is your goal this week, Brittany? Does part of you still think that you can absolutely be there on Sunday evening, even when you're not playing a full-time schedule?
I feel like it's in me somewhere. Realistically, probably not. But, I mean, it would still be great to have a good finish. Like you said, I've had some success here, finishing, you know, 20, 30th. That would be amazing. But, you know, in my head, I'm like, there's no reason why I can't play good. You know, I play at home. I make a million birdies. Why can't we come out here and do that? So it's just more, I think when you don't play all the time anymore, the mental side of it, the pressure of it gets a little bit tricky. So just kind of learning how to hone those emotions. I have a buddy caddying for me this week, so I think that'll be fun. So we'll keep it light out there on the golf course, you know, tell some jokes, and it'll just be fun to walk the fairways with a friend and maybe distract that I'm actually playing in a major. So maybe that'll make it a little easier.
Well, this week is a major, as you mentioned. It's about the golf, but also the pageantry. Big champions dinner last night. Nelly, the host, Thomas Keller, the chef. You know, great group of players that we saw in the photo. What was the meal like and the conversation in the room?
Oh, my gosh. It's truly incredible. You know, I was at a table with Morgan Pressel and Pat Hurst and Stacey Lewis, and just talking with everybody and getting to have that time together, something that, you know, we don't get to do very often. And even the Legends Junior Legacy Pro-Am on Sunday, getting to see Pat Bradley, Julie Inkster, Judy Rankin, you know, all these names of people that I idolized growing up, and then to be, you know, in the same room with eating this beautiful meal. I mean, everything came out with flowers on it and just was just set up so gorgeous. And, you know, Thomas Keller smashed it once again. Nelly's picks for the dinner menu was absolutely incredible. Every bite, you know, you were salivating, you know, waiting for that next bite. But it was just cool to be together. We can't thank Chevron enough for, you know, keeping some of those traditions alive. You know, the past champions dinner is something that means a lot to us, and we're just so grateful for them and keeping that tradition going.
Heck, if I was you, I'd come back just for the meal, much less for the golf at this point, Brittany. But one of the competitors that we just saw in that champions photograph, Amy Alcott, was with us yesterday, and she remarked how she wished some of the younger players would pick the brains more of the veterans out there in the early days of their career. You're in the veteran category now. Do you find younger players really do try to pick your brains when they're trying to find their way in the early days of their career?
Nope, which I can't agree more with Amy. You know, even at the dinner last night, Julie Inkster stood up and was kind of the host and made some comments, and then we ended up asking, so I had to ask Judy Rankin a question, and then Judy Rankin, you know, asked a younger player a question, and we kind of went around the room, which I thought was really fun. You know, the Legends players have so many wonderful stories, how they, you know, started their careers, how they managed their careers and getting where they were. So I think the younger players could learn a lot. Whether it's, you know, how many tournaments to play in a row, how did you travel, just any advice, you know, that could really help them. But I think the younger players could definitely utilize the older veteran players and really pick up some tools, because obviously those women have, in the room last night, there was so many wins and so many majors and so much talent. So there's definitely a lot to be learned.
So much institutional knowledge, so many trophies, and yet the LPGA is a tour without a commissioner at this point early in 2025. Are you concerned at all about the state of a tour that you played on for a long time, won 8 times, won 2 majors, and what the future looks like for the LPGA?
Not even the slightest. You know, Liz is our interim commissioner now, and she is crushing it. You know, Ricky Lasky and her team, there's so many good people in position at the LPGA. That we don't have the commissioner maybe right now, but the few candidates that I hear that are in the running are fantastic, and they're going to crush it whichever person they pick. So it's just a great time for the LPGA. It's a great time with women's golf. You know, the tour is only going up, getting bigger. Obviously, we see our majors elevating their purses. I think this purse this week is $8 million, which is absolutely incredible. So, you know, if we can get some of those smaller events to kind of step up their games. I mean, the tour is in such a great spot. We have so many great athletes, so many young players coming up. You know, the USGA girls golf programs that are bringing these young girls up and getting more women playing the game of golf. I mean, it's just a great time to be involved with them for sure.
Speaking of the rest of the year, Brittany, we understand why you're there this week. Such a storied history with this tournament for you. How many other times are we going to see you through the course of the season?
Maybe a couple, you know, maybe one or two in the summer when Emery doesn't have kindergarten, just kind of pack up the family and go play something in the summer. I know I don't want to take a spot from somebody, you know, I'm just kind of out there, you know, getting a few more rounds in here, just finishing out my career. But it'd just be nice to kind of pack up the family again and go play something in the summer for sure.
Well, as someone who's actually been on a tee box with you and watched you hit that beautiful draw, I have no doubt that this golf course fits your eye and your game. Thanks for the time, and best of luck this week. Have fun.
Thank you guys so much.